her staff for their assistance in putting this program together and making it a delight and very easy for us to sit here this morning. And now I'd like to call on the dean for a couple moments.
May it please the court, I'm Danielle Taha, and I have the great privilege of serving as dean here, and I simply want to thank the court for this amazing opportunity for our students, and welcome you and all our guests to this great law school, and if there's anything I can do, or any of my staff can do to make the day better, we look forward to it. And I thank counsel for being here. We have a lovely spot on the face of the earth, and it's pretty darn good law school. So, thank you all very much, and have a wonderful day here in Malvern.
Thank you. Once again, thank you all for accommodating us. Calling our first case this morning is 15-1410 Universal Electronics versus Universal Remote Control. Mr. Kang, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Peter.
We still have a live case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Last I checked right before the hearing started. May it please the court, I'm Peter Kong. I represent the appellant.
Could you speak up a little, please?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I have a sore throat, so I apologize. I'm Peter Kong. I represent the appellant Universal Remote Control. Your Honors, the district court's post-trial rulings in this case should be reversed for three basic reasons. First, at the final pretrial conference, the court put the burden on the appellee, UEI, to make a choice as to whether or not to bifurcate the case during trial. And UEI made the decision during trial not to ask for bifurcation, and by its actions consented to a binding jury verdict. Second, the court's post-trial declaration that the jury verdict was merely advisory was too late and ineffective under Rule 39 when there was no discussion of using an advisory verdict at any point during the final pretrial conference or during trial. And finally, the district court's reconsideration of overlapping factual issues that overlapped between the equitable defenses and the legal defense of improper inventorship, that reconsideration by the district judge deprived my client, URC, of its Seventh Amendment right to have a jury decide those overlapping facts.
Counsel, what's the standard of review here? First two.
At abuse of discretion. It's an issue of law, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, on the abuse of discretion question, what we've got up here is a long record that we're reviewing cold. And I know you pull snippets and your friend on the other side pulls snippets about what was said and when to go on your side. It's just hard for me. It's difficult. What is your best argument? What was your best cite in the record to establish that this well-known, long-standing jurist abused his discretion by calling it as he saw it, having sat through the trial and all of the proceedings?
The fact that the appellee, UEI, filed a Rule 50A JMAL motions on the equitable issues indicates during trial they believed, they consented, that this would be a binding jury verdict. One only files a JMAL motion under Rule 50A when it is going to a binding jury verdict.
But consent here isn't required just by the parties, but also by the court, correct? And didn't the district court make it clear during the second day of trial that it was going to decide the equitable issues?
Not exactly, Your Honor. What the procedure the district court established at the final pretrial conference was that the burden was on the plaintiff, UEI, below to decide and declare whether during trial it wanted to go into a bifurcated judge-only mode on the equitable issues. The district court gave the plaintiff below that choice and that burden. And the plaintiff below never exercised that right and never exercised that burden, made the deliberate choice to have a hometown jury decide the equitable issues instead of the court.
Well, the record's a bit unclear on that. I think what we're trying to figure out is what happened, what was agreed upon or not agreed upon before the jury began, right? We can't have a district judge after a jury trial declare whether or not a verdict by a jury was merely advisory versus being binding. But the judge here wrote an opinion that tried to explain why, under the circumstances, in the context of everything that was happening in the lead up to the jury trial, really signaled that if the jury was going to get the equitable issues, it was going to be advisory. As I recall, the proposed final pretrial order. We had one party that had a very specific conception on what to do with the equitable issues. They don't go to the jury. Then we had another party, which was your side, that said, well, we certainly want the jury to hear all the issues or the facts regarding the equitable issues. And then your side proposed that the judge would have the discretion, if he wanted to get an advisory verdict from the jury. So maybe what was going on was there was a choice between two options. Option A, the jury doesn't hear it, doesn't issue a verdict at all. Or option B, the jury does give a verdict, but it's merely advisory. And so maybe under those circumstances, given the lead up to the actual jury trial, that is what the district judge below is communicating to us as to what happened, and those were the two choices. And so under those circumstances, nobody at all contemplated a binding jury verdict. What's wrong with that basic understanding of what happened below?
Under Pradier and the other cases cited, if there's going to be an advisory jury verdict, the court has to declare ahead of time under Ninth Circuit law that it is in fact an advisory jury verdict. There is nothing in the final pretrial conference transcript where anyone talks about advisory verdict. The statement that my client made in the proposed pretrial order, which was never entered, was preceded by, in context, by a very clear statement that our side did not want bifurcation and wanted everything to go to the jury. And we were, at that point, we didn't know what was going to happen. And so we're talking about one possible alternative. We were not advocating it, and we did not advocate it at the final pretrial conference. The court never discussed it at the final pretrial conference. In fact, the district court specifically withheld judgment on this issue. The procedure, the district...
Hypothetically, you know, there's a lot of discussion going on, a lot of debate, and the debate is revolving around whether the jury is going to hear the evidence at all and issue any kind of verdict versus the jury is going to hear the issues on equitable matters and then issue an advisory verdict. If those are the only two choices that are actually ever expressed, then why wouldn't the understanding, why wouldn't it be fair for the judge to do what he did here, which is to conclude because the jury did get to hear the evidence, because the jury did issue a verdict, it was understood by everybody, given the two limited choices that were being actually discussed, that it was just going to be an advisory verdict, and nobody at any time ever said a peep about the verdict being binding.
Well, Your Honor, our position was that it should be binding, that it should, everything should go to the jury. I think that was clear. We made it clear on the record at the final.
Is there anything in the record that where your side ever used the term binding?
I don't know if we used the word binding, but we certainly advocated that everything should go to the jury. And, Your Honor, under Rule 39, the status quo is unless the district court specifically declares ahead of trial before the jury is impaneled that it is, in fact, advisory, the status quo is that it is a non-advisory jury verdict. That's what the case law teaches us.
Didn't he consistently in various contexts call himself the trier of fact and make various references to suggest that indeed the jury was advisory?
Again, context is very important. That colloquy happened on only the second day of trial when it was still possible for UEI to ask for bifurcation, and so it was still technically possible for the court to sit as a partial trier of fact if UEI chose to exercise the burden that he put on them. Furthermore, if you look in the context of that colloquy, the district court was admonishing the parties about deposition designations. This was not a colloquy on the equitable issues at all. It was about the amount of objections on depo designations with regard to prior art.
I think the district court here at some point relied on your silence or your failure to react shortly after trial, where he made absolutely clear he viewed the verdict as advisory, and your side waited a while to come forward and dispute what he had said. Is that your view of it?
No, Your Honor. That was the, if you recall, again, context is important. The verdict had, this was not an oral argument. The verdict had just been read. The jury had just been dismissed. And the court, immediately after making that comment about him being an advisory verdict, dismissed us and said, come up with a briefing schedule on what we're going to do. And there was no reason, he was certainly not inviting oral argument on whether it was advisory or not and whether or not the equitable issues should be reconsidered or not. In fact, he told us to come up with a briefing schedule to lay out exactly what our positions were. And it was not an appropriate time.
I still recall that the court at that point said that the equitable issues it was going to take on itself, and it was going to leave alone the other jury, the jury verdict as to the other issues. And the court said, is there any problem with that? Is there an objection? And you did not say, I object.
Your Honor, there was not a request for objections at that point in the hearing. He said, in fact, everyone, in his view, he said that all the parties, that he believed it was, he said, we all know those were advisory. And then, he asked us to come up with a briefing schedule to talk about this very issue. There was no reason to stand up and re-object and object at that point if he was asking for a briefing on that very issue.
What's at stake in this case?
Your Honor, our client is a small, privately held company. The attorney's fees issue and the attorney's fees decision here was precisely predicated on the error of law of taking away the defenses on the other patents that were found
now,
against
them. Now, you've already received attorney's fees on a large portion of this case, correct?
About half the case, yes, Your Honor. And so for our client, the remaining attorney's fees portion is a not insignificant amount of money as compared to the larger publicly traded company that's a plaintiff.
As a practical, functional matter, I'm not sure what you gain by succeeding in getting this case back in front of Judge Guilford, given that he's already weighed the strength of the other side's argument with respect to the patent misuse defense. In fact, he specifically found in their favor in disagreement with the jury verdict. So even if the jury verdict ultimately is deemed to be binding, to get attorney's fees, you have to really show the judge and convince the judge that their position on the patent misuse defense was really unreasonable and stands out from all the other ordinary litigation positions someone can take. And we already have on the record a very full analysis by the judge below on the strength of the matter.
But
I don't see how, as a practical, functional matter, you're going to win.
Well, the attorney's fees decision is premised on the judge being able to be a trier of fact on those issues. If we're correct and there was an error of law and the jury's verdict.
Right, but there's no rule that a prevailing party always gets attorney's fees.
No, Your Honor. But there's also the Seventh Amendment issue, right? As under the case law cited, our client is entitled to binding jury findings, both express and implicit, right, that overlap the legal defenses with the equitable defenses. And here, the improper inventorship directly overlaps the patent misuse and unclean hands defenses. And if the court did not reconsider those facts.
You're talking about a different issue.
But it plays into the attorney's fees, because if the court is bound under the Seventh Amendment to accept the jury's findings as to improper inventorship, which all overlap the equitable defenses just under the unique facts of this case, right, then the court is not in a position to reconsider and re-evaluate the facts that underlie patent misuse and unclean hands.
Well, the judge has to weigh the relative strength of anybody's litigating position, even if they end up losing, to figure out whether it wasn't so unreasonable that it warrants docking them for attorney's fees.
But it's clear from the attorney's fees order that the court re-decided those issues and did not treat the jury's verdict itself as binding in any way on the court. It is at least, at a minimum, imperative that you allow the district court to reconsider the issue.
So it's a do-over, and you don't necessarily disagree that the arrows point against you in the do-over.
We're willing to take our chances below, Your Honor.
Judge Reyna had a further question.
So go back to my prior question, and I'm trying to probe and see where we are on the issue of consent and how that the consent of the court and the consent of the parties as to which equitable issues are going to be decided by the jury. And I quoted to you just out of my own recollection the record. I kind of found a citation here. On the same day that the verdict returned its verdict, the district court said, among other things, in light of this verdict, to the extent that there were equitable issues, we all know that those were advisory. The last thing the court said there, any objection to doing that, and all the parties actually responded, no objection. So it seems going into the trial and immediately after the trial, the status quo, as the district court framed the circumstance, was that there was no consent.
Your Honor, the question immediately preceding any objection to that was, may I release the jury? The court was asking whether there was an objection to releasing the jury. And then immediately right after that said, any objection to that? Of course we didn't object to him releasing the jury. There's a sentence even preceding that where he talks about setting the schedule for briefing on the equitable issues, which precedes all that. Again, there was no reason for us to stand up and object to his comment on advisory.
There's a statement by the court on this very important issue, and you took his question, any objection to doing that, in light of everything else he had said, he took that only to refer to whether he should release a jury or not?
There was a statement that he made that he thought it was an advisory verdict. He was not inviting oral argument at that point. Immediately after that statement, he said, come up with a briefing schedule. Immediately after that, he says, I'm going to release the jury. Is there any objection to that?
Lawyers are not known for being shy. Wouldn't it have just been proper at that point for the lawyers at least to try to make sure they preserve the argument by saying, Your Honor, if you may excuse us, I'd just like to make one point about your statement? Wouldn't that be the norm rather than the exception?
This court below had admonished both parties about over-lawyering.
Don't release the jury because we still think there's work for the jury to be had.
No, Your Honor, there was no more work. The jury had delivered its verdict on the equitable defenses. If I may go to the mootness point in standing, Your Honor, there is also parallel malicious prosecution litigation going on in state court between the parties. And it is clear that reinstating the jury verdict in this case on equitable issues will have or could have evidentiary impact in that state court action. And therefore, putting aside the attorney's fees issue, which we believe there is something at stake, there's also something at stake there. And, of course, there is also ongoing second patent litigation filed by the plaintiff against my client involving similar patents, similar products. And, again, that case has been until recently was stayed. We believe reinstating the jury verdict in this case would, again, could have evidentiary impact in that second patent case.
Okay. We're out of time here. We'll restore 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Let's give it to Mr. Kassian.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, good morning. Until about 5 minutes in my friend's argument, you wouldn't have known that this was an attorney's fees dispute. It is an attorney's fees dispute, and that's all it is. The judgment here should be affirmed for two basic reasons. First, Highmark, the Supreme Court established the standard of review, is abuse of discretion. And yes, footnote 2 says that abuse of discretion often subsumes issues of law and findings of fact. But the issue of law that they say exists here, which is who was the proper trier of these issues, does not go at all to the second point that I'm going to make, which is that in Octane, the Supreme Court established that the substantive strength of a party's litigating position is the standard for determining whether or not fees should be awarded. And in this case, as Chief Judge Prost recognized earlier, a very well-regarded jurist made a very careful and granular evaluation of the record in this case.
But the real question is whether or not he did so properly, that whether or not there was a binding jury verdict that he was required to follow. Whether or not at the end of the day you go to grant attorney's fees is sort of related to Judge Chen's later question. But on that question, I mean, there's a real issue, is there not?
I don't think there's a live issue at all
clarify it a little bit. If the judge below is bound on the patent misuse defense, that in fact your side committed some form of patent misuse by deceptively changing the inventorship of the patent, and he's bound by the finding of the jury that the other side proved by clear and convincing evidence that your team, with deceptive intent, misled the PTO in believing that the inventors were these people that were actually not the inventors, then all of a sudden that becomes compelling evidence, isn't it, that they went a pretty far way in proving a serious fact that now the judge on potential remand would have to be bound by and consider and evaluate in trying to assess the relative strength of your litigation position, that maybe now, under that scenario, you didn't have a very strong position to defend.
So, Judge Chen, if I can offer you two responses to that. First, this court's decision in SFA Systems, which we briefed and which my friend here did not mention in his argument, says, and I quote, in Octane Fitness, the Supreme Court made clear that it is the substantive strength of the party's litigating position that is relevant to the exceptional case determination, not the correctness or eventual success of that position. And my second response to you is let's imagine that hypothetical remand that we're imagining together here. What does that look like? Well, that remand says, well, okay, the jury verdict is binding instead of advisory. But then, if it's a binding verdict, then we're going to have a certain period of time, now that we know that it's a binding verdict, to bring our 50B motion and renew the 50A motion, which I'll be happy to talk about why that's not any kind of waiver or consent in a moment. But then, what is the judge likely to do? Well, based on his independent equitable ruling, he's either likely to give us JMAL on this now binding verdict or, at the very least, a new trial. This is the sort of satellite litigation that SFA Systems was concerned about. Remember that in that case, Newegg appealed a case where the issues were of claim construction and I think indefiniteness, if I remember correctly in that case, were completely unnecessary. The case was over. The party had dismissed. But they wanted to appeal those things to show that the judge was wrong. And this court's decision said, we don't care about that. We're not going to take this up because that's just going to invite this sort of satellite litigation on issues that have no bearing to the ultimate result of the case.
Yeah, but I'm a little hard-pressed to accept what sounds to me like more of a policy issue. I mean, there's no real mootness. I mean, it's not really, we can't say as a matter of law that it doesn't matter and this case is moot because we are certain that the district court judge, even if we say the verdict was binding, the district court judge is not going to award attorney's fees. We might speculate about the likelihood of that, but we can, as a matter of law, say, no, we don't have to send it back if we think he was wrong.
We certainly haven't argued, Chief Judge Prost, that the case is moot, because there is a live dispute with regard to attorney's fees that our friend has brought to this court. Our point is quite different one. That is that the inquiry about correctness is under SFA Systems not relevant. It's under Octane. What's relevant is the substantive strength of a party's litigating position. And even if, in our hypothetical remand, that were to be upheld, nothing in Judge Guilford's careful decision in this case depended on or relied upon the failures of these defenses. It was an evaluation of the substantive strength. And you've got to think at this point, when you're under a very deferential abuse of discretion standard, as you are here, that the judge's careful findings about the substantive strength of the litigating positions of this case are not going to change. And they couldn't change because the issue here has to do not with the strength of the position. The strength is still...
You are, in essence, making type of a mootness argument that it doesn't matter here either way whether we agree with the other side that the verdict was binding versus advisory, because in your view, that's a sideshow. The judge has already made its ruling on the substantive strength of your side's position, and so therefore there can never in any mathematical way be a chance where the judge is going to change his mind on that score.
I don't think that that's my burden or that's on abuse of discretion. You don't have to believe that there's an absolute metaphysical certainty that under an alternate world the result would be different. Because, and I'll get to the point about why they're wrong on the law under Rule 39 and the Seventh Amendment in a second here. But with regard to the question that you're asking me, I think, Judge Chen, with all respect, that SFA Systems forecloses that sort of argument here, because SFA Systems, the court could very well have decided the claim construction issues that were underlying Newegg's appeal in that case and decided, you know, they were wrong. Under de novo review, like my friend wants here, for the Rule 39 and Seventh Amendment issues, and let's go send it back because goodness knows, maybe the judge would have made a different decision in that case. I don't think they can get over the hump of SFA Systems. Now, going beyond that to the actual substance of their Rule 39 and Seventh Amendment arguments. Let me start with this. With regard to the Rule 39 arguments, my friend fails to point out that Judge Guilford made a finding of fact on the entire record in this case, and that finding is found at A9, and it was that the court found that the parties knew at the outset that the verdict on the equitable issues was going to be advisory only. That is a finding of fact. There is no challenge on clear error grounds or abuse of discretion grounds made by our friends on the other side in this case. And that finding, I think, resolves the Rule 39 issue. And Judge Rainey, I think you pointed out in your colloquy with Mr. Kong all of the places in the record that amply support such a finding. So even if there had been a clear error argument, there would be no clear error here.
Do you agree that the right time frame to judge whether or not the jury, that there was an agreement on whether a jury verdict on an equitable issue should be binding versus advisory, the time frame we should be looking at is right on the eve of the beginning of the trial, that any statements or discussions that occurred during the trial or after the trial are ultimately irrelevant on the legal question of whether a verdict should be binding?
No, I can't agree with that, because it really does require an evaluation.
There's case law that says, you know, the parties need to know ahead of time, before the trial begins, whether, you know, a verdict is going to be merely advisory versus binding. So everything needs to be rolled up and understood and decided before the trial even begins.
And
am I misremembering the case?
I think there are cases that reflect exactly that principle, and I think here on this record you have the pretrial orders, which were...
So therefore, then, the statements made by Judge Guilford during the trial are irrelevant.
Oh, no,
I can't... The statements he makes after the jury has been released are likewise irrelevant.
Can't agree at all that they're irrelevant. That doesn't follow at all with respect, Your Honor.
Or the focus really needs to be on what are the statements and agreements, concessions,
sure,
or non-agreements.
Let's focus on those statements that took place pre-trial. If you look at A18462, that is docket entry number 275, that is our contentions of fact and law. That was incorporated into our portion of the pretrial order, which my friend says was never adopted, which is at A21838. That's our view. So that's our view pre-trial, that this is going to have, these are equitable issues that are going to go to the court. And I might add, by the way, that my friend has set up this dichotomy that the only way we could have possibly preserved our right to have an equitable determination on these issues is by asking for bifurcation. Well, the judge made it pretty clear he didn't want bifurcation, but that was hardly a waiver of our position that this was always going to be equitable. Now, if you look at URC's portion of that same pretrial order, 21847, it says, and this is an alternative argument, because of course they did want everything to be in front of the jury, although they didn't say anything about binding. I think you were the one who asked my friend about whether they used the term binding. They just said it should be presented to the jury. And they say in the alternative, the court may in its discretion seek an advisory verdict from the jury after the evidence of unclean hands is presented. And they cite Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 39C. I think it's very hard in light of that statement for them to now say that they thought at the outset of trial that there was an expectation that everything was going to be binding, when, in fact, in their own portion of the joint pretrial order, they're saying the court has the discretion to make this advisory. And of course, Judge Guilford did exactly that.
If you file a Rule 50A motion, that doesn't make any sense to me. It's not consistent with your position that it was only going to be an advisory.
It actually is, Your Honor.
The jury was just not really a meaningful player in the process.
It actually is, Your Honor. First of all, as with most Rule 50A motions during trial, it was an omnibus motion, so it was addressing all of the issues which were unquestionably going to the jury for a binding resolution. But secondly, look at the text of Rule 50A. Look at the title. It talks about a motion in a jury trial. Right? It doesn't say in a binding jury trial. And frankly, if I were advising a client at trial, and we, of course, weren't the trial counsel here, but if I were advising a client at trial how to preserve this error, I would certainly say, yeah, you can bring a Rule 50A motion. It applies to taking things out of a jury trial. And quite frankly, remember that as an advisory jury, it had to be instructed on the law. It had to reach its advisory verdict. But if we could get it out of the case, so much the better. It'll streamline the case. I would advise...
Case, Why didn't you renew your request for bifurcation?
I think that although I can't say subjectively, I can say on this record it seems quite clear that the judge was not going to bifurcate because he had allowed a limited amount of time and he had made comments on the record.
He left open that issue and said, I'm going to take this up later and I'm going to leave it up to you to re-argue that I should bifurcate. You never did remake that argument.
No, we didn't. And that was quite frankly, I think, again, I can't say subjectively. I can only say objectively based on this record since I wasn't there and I wasn't the trial decision maker. But what I can say about the record here is that the judge had made very clear that he had allocated a certain number of days at trial and he viewed the request for bifurcation.
That would be the cleanest way in order to have a separation of the equitable issues and the other issues.
It would have been.
You didn't take the clean way.
Well, we tried to take the clean way, and what I'm trying to get out and across to you, Your Honor, is that Judge Guilford made very clear that this was going to be an eight-day trial. He viewed bifurcation as an effort to try to get more trial days, and whether that was right or not, bifurcation, of course, was not the only way that we could have preserved this as an issue. There's one last remaining issue, I think, that I haven't addressed. Oh, by the way, one last point, Judge Chin, with regard to the 50A argument. We've cited copious cases in our brief, and there are more beyond that, where courts in this circumstance have converted Rule 50A motions to 52 motions to be challenges to bench findings as opposed to jury trials. But finally...
I'm sorry, and one more thing. When your side objected to the res judicata question going to the jury... You didn't, at the same time, object to the patent misuse defense going to the jury. Instead, your side was working on trying to develop what would be the best kind of jury instruction there.
Well,
why,
we knew.
Why?
We knew that the court was going to have an advisory jury, so we had to have an instruction. You can't have an advisory jury without a jury instruction to guide the jury. But one last point that I haven't addressed yet from my friend is his Seventh Amendment argument. And the underlying premise of his Seventh Amendment argument is that the jury's improper inventorship verdict implicitly found all of the things with regard to the equitable defenses like bad faith, improper purpose, and knowing it was invalid. Look at the jury instruction. Look at the jury verdict form. The inventorship verdict question only asks, do you find that URC has proven by clear and convincing evidence that the 426 patent is invalid for improper inventorship. That was the verdict form. And the jury instruction itself said nothing about bad faith or improper purpose or knowing it was invalid. Rather, it was focused entirely on the proper question for inventorship, which was the contributions to the invention.
Last question.
Yes.
You want this to be reviewed on use of discretion standard rather than a de novo standard?
I think that's because what Highmark says.
But what order are we supposed to look at to give deference to the judge's interpretation of that order and give, you know, discretion to that interpretation?
So I think the order that we have offered in our brief, which is the question you are asking is the Optane question, which is whether the substantive strength of the party's litigating positions.
I'm sorry, I'm talking more about whether, if we have to decide whether this verdict was binding or advisory, is that question a question of law or abuse of discretion?
Well, I think it might ultimately be a question of discretion because it in part here has to do with the judge's own interpretations of his prior orders, which is reviewed for abuse of discretion. It has to do with what the judge understood to be the party's understanding at the beginning of trial.
Is there
which
a
is
case
the,
that says that?
I think the best thing that I can tell you is that if you look back at SFA Systems, for example, where the court did not entertain the appeal on the underlying issues. But in terms of our order of hierarchy, we think that you don't have to reach the Rule 39 issues. You start with the attorney's fee issue. And if the finding, the holding that the substantive strength of the party's litigating position is not an abuse of discretion, that should be the end of the issue. If you get into the Rule 39 and Seventh Amendment issues, there are legal questions there, but it's really the application this entire record and the and what happened both on and perhaps off the record as well, the judge's finding that the parties understood at the beginning of the trial, subject to clear error review, ultimately his determination, since there is not really any Seventh Amendment issue here, is a question of his discretion in the application of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We've restored 2 minutes, which turns out to be exactly the extra time that Mr. Castagna has had. So perfect. You've got 2 minutes.
That's Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, on the standard of review, the Thompson case, the Beretta case, the Garza cases, all the cases that were cited on Rule 39, all decide those issues as a matter of law. And so we believe here that since there was an error of law.
Is that what those cases actually say?
They do deal with it as an issue of law.
They
yes,
say it's a de novo question?
Yes, Your Honor. And the case law we cited makes clear that an error of law is inherently an abuse of discretion, and therefore, on the fee issue part of it, the reason there should be a remand, even under SFA systems, is because
it's pretty hard to consider this as a question of law when we're talking about, as we spoke to you a few minutes ago, statements that were made and an understanding of statements that were made and the context in which they were made. I mean, somebody's got to make that decision, and certainly you wouldn't disagree, I think, that the district court makes it in the first instance. So those certainly seem to me to be kinds of factual questions that would get discretionary review, no?
No, Your Honor, because these are applications of a federal rule of civil procedure. There's no facts to be decided. This is what happened in the trial record below is what happened. There's no discussion of advisory using an advisory verdict explicitly before trial at the final pretrial conference. He never declared that. Under the controlling case law, the parties are entitled to know whether or not the jury is merely going to be advisory. Further,
you're setting up a black letter law that if the judge doesn't say that it's going to be advisory expressly, then it's absolutely binding, regardless of context and circumstances.
The
word advisory has to come out of the judge's mouth before the trial begins.
The trial counsel
rule?
Yes, Your Honor, because the other circuits that have ruled on this issue, the Ninth Circuit that have ruled on this issue, have said, as Your Honor noted, trial counsel is entitled to know before the jury's impaneled and chosen what kind of jury it's going to be, and that absolutely affects the trial strategy and trial presentation. Counsel here speculated as to what could happen upon remand. This goes to our very point that if there were somehow he speculated that JMAL could be granted, first of all, that won't happen because the court here, the district court, denied summary judgment on the very equitable issues we're talking about. And furthermore, the Rule 50 motions were filed, and no Rule 52 motions were filed by UEI to try to amend the judgment. All right. And so if they really believed it was an advisory verdict, their actions or their failure to act show that they did not believe it was a binding, that it was an advisory jury verdict.
Thank you. We thank both counsel and the case is submitted.